help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up, refresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Hi, I'm Madeline McGurk. I'm speaking to you from Edinburgh in Scotland, and I'm the Managing Director of the International Teaching Artists Collaborative.
So what is ITAC?
So ITAC, basically, it goes by ITAC, ITAC, depending on which country you're from. But essentially what it is it's a network of socially engaged artists or practitioners. Anyone in my country, we call it participatory arts. In the States, it's teaching artists or community artists. And that's my background. So I love to get to work with people who have that same kind of passion. Basically, ITAC runs free ongoing professional development opportunities. We develop resources, fund projects. We hold international conferences every 2 years. And basically just provide spaces at various levels where teaching artists can gather and network and generally support each other, with the hope that that leads to some sort of strategic advocacy and support that can coalesce a field around a given agenda or objective. My favourite description ever of ITAC was from a feedback form, and it said we were the Disneyland for teaching artists. So if I could get that on a banner, I absolutely would do that. And I should also mention, when I talk about ITAC, that I have been in the mix since we became a year-round organisation, but it's the brainchild of Marit Ulvant, who's in Norway, and Eric Booth, who's in the USA. And they're quite well known in our field, but it was really, they noticed this missing and this need for this support network. And so they moved ahead with developing these conferences every 2 years and then eventually bringing in a year-round organization, which I now lead.
Why did you decide, why was it named international, like teaching artists instead of socially engaged artists or participatory artists? Because I mean, for me, it was quite misleading. When I heard it, I was like, oh, so I have to teach if I want to join it.
Yeah, there's a sort of inference that it's something to do with schools, I think, if you have teaching there. Really, I think it was a practical thing of between Norway and the States, and that's the common language the two share. And then sort of developing the field beyond that, we have to try and be very clear. It's like socially engaged practitioners of any kind are welcome. But I guess with international work, there are so many translations and iterations of different names. And especially because this is a new field, like so many people do it and don't know that that's what it's called, or like don't know that they do the thing we're talking about. And so it often springs up organically all over the place. And so people just generally don't have a title for it, or they have their own specific thing they want to be called. So we are very broad with the term teaching artist. It's like, that's the word we have because we have to have a word, but ignore it if it doesn't serve you, basically.
You know, it's actually not that young or new, because it's been around for a while, but then it's as you said, you know, because it's been developing in so many different pockets of the world, and there isn't any sort of clear definition. Also, because as a practice, it's evolving. It's still mm-hmm. evolving. It's still finding its way, and people are still finding their styles. And there are so many different ways of working. Like some people work with theater, but some people, you know, facilitation, that's their art.
Right.
And then, you know, like, even among practitioners in this field, people, there isn't one definition, because there can't be one definition.
Yeah.
And then when I talk to people who are outside of my practice, it's very difficult to explain. Oh, they don't know what it is. They don't understand it. And if you've not experienced it, you cannot really understand it. You know, I'm talking about like, yeah. Oh, you know, it's a wonderful and beautiful thing. You come together, yeah. You open up a space for vulnerability, you connect, and it transforms people and lives. And they're like, what do you mean it transforms people in life? I do that in my badminton club. We talk, like, is that what it is? So is this like a counseling therapy thing? But then it's not exactly, yet there are elements of it. And because there are so many soft skills that you need in community engaged arts, socially engaged arts, that everything kind of finds its way in the process. And then when you tell people, like, you know, it's the process that's important, it's not the end product. Talking to businesses and companies and even organizations and governments, they're just like, what is the KPI, the key performance indicators? What are your metrics? And it cannot be measured this way, you know, you can't put numbers to a human experience.
I know, it's interesting because you're right. I mean, the practice is as old as, you know, cave paintings, I imagine.
And indigenous.
There will have been people doing this work for centuries because it is the most human thing in the world to try and support each other, I think. And a really key way of doing that is engaging each other. But I suppose when I say young, I just mean the recognition that it's a sector is kind of young, or outside of our own work, as you've just said, like, people don't really recognize it and they don't understand the value and the power that can be harnessed, basically. I still have a really hard time talking to people who have never been in the arts or in creativity and voicing exactly what it is that teaching artists do, because it's so different. And if it's too prescriptive, you leave out like half the field. Yep. So I always try and describe it as, I heard Eric say it in a talk once, but it's people who activate artistry in others. So it's not necessarily to create more artists or to, you know, make people really good at one particular art form, but it's to engage minds and shift perceptions and open up pathways that didn't exist before. And so for us, when we now have to talk about KPIs and things like that, we talk about behavior and what is really something that actually impacts perception, what really changes minds and hearts and yes. habits. And we know that is some kind of engagement experience. Like, yes. we're talking about learning, not just hearing facts. And learning happens when an individual is engaged. And so we are saying, okay, well, we are the workforce that can effectively engage people. And we know teachers have been doing this for a long time and now are skewing towards creativity because we know those are the most effective learning tools. So we're like, okay, hi, we're the people that have been doing this. And that's kind of how we approach it now.
And the transformation, the inner transformation, personal transformation, it happens when there are emotions, when people are emotionally engaged and they respond and they have like perspective change. And the power of the arts to be able to facilitate that space, that is the power that can transform societies. Yet it's so difficult, I find, to communicate that through like the very metrics driven world. And one of the really good points that you were mentioning also, that it's considered young because it's a sector that was just sort of recently recognized. And you know, this is something that I've been really struggling with these days, which is that, I mean, well, when I set up INSEP, International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners, that was also because, you know, I was in my university from a theater course, but then realizing that, you know, I want to do socially engaged works, but I don't know people around me who has the expertise, who knows what it is, who understands the vulnerabilities or ethics around it. And then I decided, okay, well, let's start something and connect people. And back then I was engaged with European Academy of Participation. I was doing projects with them. So that's Lars who got me in touch with you, I think. And then from there on, really realizing like all these diverse fields and expertise and so much transformation and the power that these artists and practitioners, be it like in theater spaces or even architects, urban planners, that they have with communities. And yet, you know, the sort of financial sustainability and independence of it, it's so difficult. And when I started INSEP, the main research that I embarked on was how can this be financially independent and sustainable on its own? And then I went to the social sector, worked in European projects, and I realized, you know, funding isn't the way. And then I went to social enterprises, and it's like, I mean, social entrepreneurship model would work, but the thing is, it's not a clear-cut product that you're selling. It's not even really like a service, you know? And how do you define that? And then in the end, it comes down to what you were talking about, actually being recognized. And if all around the world, grassroots movements are expected to be something that's volunteered, then we will never get to a stage where this is recognized, properly recognized as a profession and a service to be paid for. And I'm not, I'm not saying that I want everything to be commodified, because I don't really agree with capitalism either. But the thing is that our artists need to survive, and they need to live. They need to pay their rent, their bills, and they need to support their family members. How is it that we can expect people with this expertise to facilitate, to, you know, that actually does so much to impact, positively impact communities and people, to not be able to be compensated for the value that they're bringing into society? It doesn't make sense. And this is the key to like social and environmental healing, because if this profession is properly recognized and acknowledged as a profession to be paid for, that governments and businesses would pay their services for, then this is going to provide so many jobs in community care, which is going to be the future of work that is not dependent on exploiting natural resources to produce products or to produce more tech companies that doesn't know what they're innovating for. And this is serving a real human need. And, you know, I'm going to stop soon, but, you know, it's like how childcare used to be something that communities would do for free for each other. But then because of the world, the system that has evolved, it has become something that is commodified. It has become like a service. And if the world has progressed to this point where all of the things that were traditionally done for free are not free anymore, then, you know, at some point, socially engaged arts, these sort of grassroots civic engagement needs to get to that point as well for people who are doing it as a profession to be able to feed themselves.
Right. And I totally agree. And I think, like, to me and you, it seems so obvious that, you know, are these people doing this work are the hearts and, you know, the souls of communities, and that they are essential key workers. And I mean, post-pandemic, my God, even more so, it's going to be like, who is going to respond to the mental health crisis and to the fractured communities and the isolation? Like, clearly, you know, there will be doctors at hand and social workers and people taking care of those kind of things. But then everything else, like, how are we expecting that to be healed or to be addressed in any real way? And equally, though, I think, and maybe this is, you know, naive hopefulness, but I also think there's something to be said about, we can't blame politicians for not seeing our worth if we aren't bringing it to them and showing it to them all the time. Because, you know, there are unions of other types of sectors, there are strong advocates, there are lobbyists, there are, you know, people who've been, you know, well set up institutions to do exactly that for science and technology and all these other fields. And we're, you know, very community focused often in our work. So the people in the room get it, they know instantly. People in the audience, if you're doing a performance, often get it. And anyone beyond that goes, oh, that sounds nice. And you're like, no, 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 it's not nice. It's transformative. It's like, it's shifting things.
Yep.
And unless we get really loud and smart and strategic about making that case, I think we're going to have a hard time proving it. Or unless we start having more artists in government. I mean, that's the other way. Have people in the government to get it.
So difficult. But,
right, exactly. If there's a specific kind of person that tends to be elected, certainly here in the UK, tends to be elected, and they've all gone to like two schools, and, you know, it's a whole system. And that's another show. But this is... the way that we can do this is by changing the minds that make the decisions. And they all have sustainable development goals to meet. They all have briefs, yes, and they all have timelines, and they all have policies. And we know that they can achieve them by a multi-pronged approach with teaching artists, at least in part achieve them. So I'm like, we have an antidote to these problems. They just don't know it. And whatever case we're making isn't working, clearly. Yes. So we need to shift, and we need to find a new way of addressing it, because I agree, it shouldn't be a commodity you have to buy, and it shouldn't ask people to just volunteer their time every single time. So it needs to be seen as a core community approach to poverty or climate change or isolation or all these different things that we know our network are equipped to address.
Yeah. This is... So I enrolled myself on a business course because I thought that would help me find a way to make this work. And the language is very different. So like, what is your unique selling point? What is it that you're going to sell? And then when I try and explain that this addresses everything from climate change to community to whatever, they're like, no, you have to only address one thing. And yeah. people don't fundamentally understand it. And then when I go to like governments and ministries and stuff, it's it feels a bit like a power play. Like unless you're at a position that's high enough that you're making loud enough noise, then they would listen to you. And then otherwise it's just, you know, how is this going to benefit me? And like also me in my role, my position, my reputation or whatever. And then something that I realized was that I'm not sure about the UK, maybe it's a bit similar, but I learned over the months that in Singapore, the language that we use to speak, it's so different in different sectors. So in the arts, we speak, I think it's a more qualitative language. But it's stuff that, you know, people from a metrics-driven perspective cannot really get. For them, it's like emotions, vulnerability, whatever. It doesn't mean anything to me. Show me the data, you know. Yeah. For businesses, like I've been talking to VPs, presidents, and you know CEOs of whatever companies, they tell me that if you want to apply to any sort of CSR funding, it's very direct. You know, what is it that the company can benefit in terms of reputation or in terms of outreach? What is it that makes your application so much better than thousands of other applications that I'm receiving? And I feel like fundamentally, if this is what we're in for, if to make the sort of socially engaged works, we have to apply for one, either government funding or two, be begging private companies to compete with many other organizations that are doing social change work, it's not sustainable. And we need to find other ways of breaking out of this. And if we want to break out of this, we need to look at different spaces, different ways of innovative thinking and strategies, maybe social enterprises. That's a model that can work for us as well. But we need to change the language to a certain extent as well, so that the rest of the system understands what is it that we are doing and that they would be able to commission it.
Right. I totally agree. I think what we need is, like, as cynical as it probably sounds, is like PR. We need comms. We need people who understand the language that those people need and can help us like asset map, okay, what do you have? Because for example, if you like in Latin America, I always think of Inés Sanguinetti and Career Villa Peña in Argentina and the community shifts that have happened there or in other parts of South America with like El Sistema and that whole movement. And we're like, okay, here are communities completely shifted. I mean, completely transformed within like 10 years based on an artistic program or community engagement lab in Vermont, completely shifting whole ecosystems of society, but in little pockets, right? The whole of Latin America isn't changed, but this part of Argentina has shifted and the way the community relates to each other has shifted. And up in Vermont with a mural project, the same kind of thing is happening. And we're like, so these things are working and they are happening and they are proving the thing that we are, you know, loftily talking about us being able to do. So it can work. But what happens with that data afterwards, or like after beyond those pockets of success, how are we taking that and saying, okay, well, I'm in Scotland, which, you know, I can assume our policymakers don't know about Vermont or Argentina or wherever else in the world this is succeeding. So how do I take those? What can we provide to teaching artists where they can basically copy and paste, where they can take it and show it as proof that the practice does the thing and have the right language or words and have the percentages and, you know, outcomes by numbers that you and I probably cringe at, but they need to tick a box on a form to release the funds. And then after they start to get it, I hope that starts to shift. But I think you have to meet people where they are. And I think, unfortunately, that means we have some work to do around how do we present the case to the people that have the resources and then bring them on board afterwards. I'm always trying to think about the answer to that.
You know, I feel like there are resources around and there are research that's already sort of out there. It's just that because there isn't like a centralized way of gathering all of that. So everything is just in different corners of the world. And it's like, you have to dig and dig and dig until you chance upon it. And it's like, oh, voila, that's there. And because recently I was, yesterday night I had a recording with Oridae. And then we just started to search online on like community engagement arts in Singapore. And apparently there was funding for such a report and research to be made. And I mean, it was based on one organization, but they did phrase it pretty well in a way that is kind of understandable for even people outside of the field. And I think there are all these reports around. So one of the research that I've been doing through INSEP is also like ways of organization. So I don't know if you've heard the podcast with Inspiral, but Inspiral is a network that works on a horizontal organizational method. And they use, tools like Lumio that allows for people to pretty much be autonomous in the work that they do, but then figures out a way in which people can collaborate without that sort of hierarchy, and that allows for faster decision making. And I was really constantly thinking about how INSEP could be a network that is horizontal and allows for people to put in the information where it's applicable, so that it's not all on me to do all of that work. And then, you know, this is going to be something that is a growing resource that supports each other. And, you know, something that I was thinking of is that we have people who are working on the ground. We have the network. And if we can activate everyone to share something on social media, that's going to travel far, you know? If we are doing a campaign, that's going to reach many different corners of the world. Something that I've been learning about advertisements, it's also that with digital marketing nowadays, you have to pay to stay in the game. Mm-hmm. So there's like all of that, and then Google Analytics or whatever. But I fundamentally believe in the power of bottom-up communities, because if every, like, this was one of my, like, I guess, vision for INSEP when I started as well, because if everyone is working with a community, then if there is a way to connect all of the dots, all of the practitioners around, then we have such a wide reach, you know, to talk about issues, to talk about things that matters, to share information. And we have that. Mm-hmm. So there are things that we can do. It's just about how to activate that in a way where people can act on. Because I feel also if it's something that requires a lot of energy and effort and commitment, because people in this field tend to be quite busy, either trying to get funding or doing the work that they're doing, or trying to do another job to make ends meet, that it's very difficult to ask for more time, also because everyone's hands are tied.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think we've had all of the same impulses. With ITAC, we had a resources page, or we have a resources page, which we hoped to build out into this, you know, central place where people could just tag us in something and we could add it, and then you could filter by all this various, you know, participation and participant age groups, ranges, community, all the rest. And then we started looking at, okay, how do you gather this? And then it was like, okay, this is like, it needs to be its own website, because then you've got academic, you've got anecdotal, yeah, you've got quantitative, qualitative, and all these different things. And you're like, okay, and then how do you highlight the parts people need without them having to read a 40-page journal? And then it was one of our innovator projects last year was looking at building the beginnings of a resource center. And so they've been for the last year pulling in various strands from different parts of the world. And we had a think tank where we invited an international group to talk about a couple of resources they each liked or used. And so we've gathered that. But then it's like, okay, how do you display it? And then if we want to have this filterable resource, you know, mega center somewhere that can be open source and free and downloadable and translatable and all these things, then you need mega money to create the site. I have the impression there are a lot of fields and volunteer energy in, you know, who are tech sector based or finance sector based, who are kind of looking to do this, but from their own perspective and for their own reasons. And so I think there's a huge amount that could be done reaching out and trying to find those people and identify those strands. In itself, that would be like a full-time job and a two-year project probably. So that comes back to your comment about, well, who's paying these people? Because if we just keep asking artists to volunteer and we keep asking, you know, underpaid, underappreciated social practitioners to do the work, that's just not really going to cut it. So then it comes back to, okay, well, how do we organize around this? And I think it probably has to come in stages. And so we're channeling some resources just now into our comms strategy and into thinking about online social media campaigns around the visibility of teaching artists, even if it's just here are the faces of teaching artists, here's an interview with them, just to be churning that out and showing how many corners of the world they exist in, age ranges, backgrounds, everything totally different. And my hope is that will be the first step in a sort of bigger visibility campaign. Every time we have our conferences and you meet the most, I mean, you were there for this. This was digital, it was meant to be in Korea, but went online last year. The people and the energy and the inspiration that it is just to be in the room or hear these people talk. I mean, if we could capture like a tenth of that and bring that to social media, someone would be surprised and someone would listen and someone would go, huh, that's interesting. I wonder more about that. So I think, it's just finding the right one. I mean, you try 10 doors and then one opens, right? So it's just like finding that one that will get us where we need to go.
I wonder also if the social media strategy should be targeted at social media platforms like LinkedIn instead, because that is where the money's at.
This one's not so much about money generating, I suppose, as it is about coalescing people around the idea that they're in a sector and then being proud of that and wanting to amplify that by adding their own voice to it. So this is less about, well, I guess it's two strand. It is about amplifying the voices beyond our own field, but it is also to try and activate people to contribute their own voice to that effort. So it's a sort of two-pronged approach of it, like, get loud about the fact you're doing this and then get loud to other people about the fact you're doing this. And so it's sort of a platform that can happen. It's not going to, I don't think, immediately generate income or that kind of thing, but hopefully it will start the ball of seeping into the consciousness of other people, which is the beginning. I mean, all of this just happens in such small steps, and I wish we could jump to step 7. So this is our like little initial step into that process, I guess.
How did you end up working for ETAC? What's your background?
It's socially engaged art. I think like you, I have a background in the theatre and in filmmaking. So I did youth theatre forever. Anyone who would watch me, I would be like, come and see me do a show. I've never been accused of being shy. So I started in youth theatre and then I went on and I studied acting and filmmaking and I trained and then I did, I trained and I did the student TV station. I ended up running the factual division of our student TV station and creating all the news and everything for the university. And then that entailed a bit of training where I would train the new people on how to use the studio equipment. And then I just loved that. It was so much fun. And then getting to go out and make things together and then make things that other people would then engage with and be like, huh, I didn't know that. And then that was a whole new thing. Then I ended up freelancing as a youth theatre teacher for a while, alongside acting gigs and filmmaking and just doing the freelance thing of like a bit of everything. And then I ended up being brought into a national charity here in Scotland as they're a national educational organization. And I was brought in as their filmmaker teaching artist who worked with teenagers who had either recently arrived in the country or didn't have English as a language or just had, you know, a marginalized background in some respect. And we worked on filmmaking projects to explore the idea of citizenship and of active engagement in community. And so that was the first time where I was really doing the teaching artist work beyond a youth theatre setting. And I was hooked. I mean, working with the teenagers was the most amazing experience and I loved it. And I was just like, when you talk about the deeper level of understanding, that's when it really came. I was like, okay, I intellectually understood a lot of this, but now it's like visceral. And so that was huge. And I went, okay, acting's not enough anymore. This is not giving me this. I want to do this. And I, you know, I still do the odd acting job, but not really. This is much more my passion now. So anyway, so then I was promoted within that organization a few times and I became the director of it. And then I was in these meetings with governments and, you know, European Union officials and all this, and trying to convince them as to why this needed funded. And my job shifted significantly towards big picture. So I didn't really get to go into the classrooms as much, but I got to be the reason other people got into the classrooms, and that was cool. And then ITAC, this opportunity came up, and I was like, okay, I didn't even know there was this network of people doing this work at a really high level all around the world. So then I joined 2 days a week. We launched in 2018 after the fourth conference, and we instigated this year-round presence because the conferences had been going since 2012, but this organization was in 2018. And then I was brought on board to set it up, to constitute it, to, you know, do the applications and the legal stuff around getting it to be a real organization that was overseen and had trustees and a board.
What does it register this?
It's a SCIO, so it's a Scottish Charitable Incorporated organization, which in Scotland, this is very boring, but in Scotland we have a sort of quite well developed and recently overhauled kind of charity law system. So it's actually quite a good place to be if you're a charity, because the sort of archaic laws about all the different ways you have to register and prescribe and admin, they don't really apply. It's very, very well governed. So, you know, there is a very robust system in place, but it's just much more friendly to charities in terms of recognizing it's a small staff. So annual accounts are needed and not too much else. So anyway, so I set all that up for us and then became full-time about a year ago, just over a year. And so now it's like, I just get to do the thing that I love the most for, you know, every day and meet people and try and connect them and see how we can work together to shift things and move the dial a little bit. And so we're about to launch, I think it's like 12 projects this year or something. All international, all multidisciplinary, and, you know, with various focuses. And it's just, yeah, sometimes I have to pinch myself. I just, if COVID hadn't happened, I would have had the most international year last year of speaking at things and traveling and meeting people. But hopefully that opens back up soon. Our next steps are, we have a lot of international partnership projects among artists for field development, for things that will look at a specific topic and give a specific outcome which will serve the rest of the field. So that's really our focus right now, is creating stuff that will serve people who weren't in the room. And it's like, whether that's other teaching artists who need, you know, a toolkit or a how-to model to do something of their own without spending hours researching, we're gonna have them. This resource center, we're doing a lot more thinking about that. We're also looking at the idea of national hub building and having these sort of nodes, because, you know, for any network there have to be active and responsive nodes. It can't just be a centralized power. So we are in talks with, I think, four countries and four organizations about hosting an ITAC hub in their country, which will serve the community and can do a lot more grassroots cultivation than we can from an international level. And if that comes off, that would be, I mean, game-changingly huge for us.
How would that hub work? Would each country will have to find funding on their own to support that?
Yeah, we do not have the resources to be funding people to do it, unfortunately. But what we can do is, if a country or organization is in a place where they're remit is looking to engage on an international level while serving the national field, then we can provide, you know, quite a bit of resources, expertise, input, all of that kind of stuff from people who've done it before, or people who understand it and have been doing it for 30 years and can give the advice on how to do the next thing. or just ongoing professional development, really. And because we don't want to be some sort of like some kind of power telling people what to do, the hubs will be really different in each country. It's going to be totally devolved, and you know, what is needed in New Zealand is different to what's needed in Norway. And so they will do totally different stuff. But regularly, the leaders of the hubs will come together to set some kind of cohesive direction around, okay, we're serving our national organizations, but what can we do internationally to bring in countries that aren't here, or to serve places that don't have these resources yet? How can we develop those? And then it becomes more of a strategic approach to developing the field beyond, you know, the odd project or resource.
I guess something that I felt when I first started researching was that there was just so much information everywhere. And it gets to a point where it's just, it's overwhelming. Like, if I managed to read every single article, I would be stuck on one website for 10 years.
Yeah. And our goal has always been to collate that information somewhere. But like I said before, how you do that and the practicalities actually involved in that are huge. So I imagine in 10 years, we'll still be trying. But I mean, I'm willing to be there in 10 years still trying. So I think, yeah, it's a worthwhile pursuit, but it's a fairly nuanced and complex one.
Maybe Siri's going to do it.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Siri can collate all of this information.
Give me the qualitative and quantitative report. I want it for governments.
Siri, can you just tell the government?
Just give me the money.
Right?
Yeah, like this is actually the work that governments should be doing. Like, tell them that they should give me the funding for it.
Yeah, maybe let's hope that that develops in the next few years. That would be a gift.
Maybe I should send this podcast link to like tech companies and stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do. I think we do need to think more seriously about how we engage the tech world. But again, that's a whole conversation of its own. But it needs to happen. It needs to be seen as the tool through which any sector can do the thing they want to do. So, yeah,
I was at Copenhagen Tech Festival, I think that was what it was called, a couple of years ago. And it was very interesting because, I mean, honestly, people working in tech are comfortable because, you know, they get paid pretty high and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was quite surprised that in the presentations and the sessions, people were really talking about, like, yeah, sure, I'm earning good money, but I don't find a meaning and purpose, and I want to do something with my skills to do something meaningful. So it's just about sort of getting to the right spaces. But then I also realized that we need to have something consolidated that we can bring to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's like they want to do something, I'm sure, that feels meaningful and useful, but they also are used to speaking the language that we aren't fluent in. So then it's like, for them to even bring a case as to why this is the thing, we need to have the vocabulary to convince them that this is the thing. And that's where I think there's more work to be done, bringing what we know to the field in a way that other people understand it. And that vocabulary is completely different in every country too, based on government priorities and what company is the most fashionable at that moment. It all kind of shifts, but yeah, I think it can happen, and I think with the kind of hub structure it's more likely to be effective, so we'll see. I think I really am a firm believer it only takes one, just the right door, and then you're in. So I mean, if we're working until we're 80, we've got like 50 60 years to figure out which door it is, so I think I'm hopeful.
But, you know, I really feel like change making in our world, in our current context, in the urgency of the climate crisis, we need to have more cross-sectoral conversations and collaborations. And yet I found myself in a position where I was trying to do that. And it's either I have to do it voluntarily and spend a lot of time in organization, communication and all of that, and not be able to sustain myself, or I would try and ask for funding and nobody wants to fund it because it's almost like a positive externality. you know, I'm not going to be the only beneficiary of it. I don't see the value of it yet because I can't see how it fits into my KPI and it's going to be extra work for me. Do I want to do it? And then who funds this sort of capacity building work, which is so important because, you know, tech might have the solution, but they might not know what the problem is or what the thing is to create. And we have that. And it's, you know, sometimes bridging that, sharing that would spark these sort of ideas and innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think it's just finding the right person and finding the right time and the right cause, because we know we have the answer. We know we have the answer and the skills. So at some point, and I think now everything is shifting anyway. I mean, the world has changed and we'll have to set a decision about how to go back or how to go forward. And so I was saying this to someone the other day, like, those decisions are being about to be made. Where do we start funding? Where do we recover? What do we save? What do we not? And so I think these are really good moments to be getting loud and to saying, yeah, I know you were funding that before and that seemed great, but here's this other thing that's actually much more essential and urgent. Here's the solution to that thing you were wondering about. You were going to funnel money in. Here's a way to do it that will have a social impact beyond just the economic beneficiaries. So, yeah. I mean, I could go around about it for days. I firmly believe we have the answer and that if we just need to make people understand it.
What do you think has been the impact of artists in UK, in Scotland, since the pandemic?
It's been decimated. It's ground to a halt. Live performance has never resumed in Scotland. Like in England, I think there were moments, there was like a month or there were 2 months where things had started to open up. We've never had live performance back in Scotland, as far as I know. Here in Edinburgh, we have the International Festival every year, the Fringe Festival and all of that. That's been cancelled for...
It was online, no? I think it went online.
The population of Edinburgh doubles every August and there are like 40,000 shows a month or something. Like it's not a big city. So it's like every little unused corner of the city becomes a performance space and it's everything is transformed and the economy just booms and, you know, it's wild. And that was cancelled last year. I don't think it's going to happen this next year. And all of these kind of things have just stopped and they're really the lifeblood of our performers. A lot of people in Scotland work for August, if no other part of the year, because there are that many shows. I'm less clued in about England because although we are still governed by Westminster in Scotland, we have a lot of devolved powers. So we also have our own parliament, which means things like arts and education are set by Scottish government. And happily, they have a radically different approach to England, which tends to lean a lot more to the conservative side. Our government tends to value arts more highly, I would argue. For example, our Creative Scotland, which is our national funding body here, have a remit for justice and for health and for all of these different things. So the health minister has to cooperate with the arts minister and they have to have joint projects. And the same with, you know, prisons, they have to have art projects that go on there. And there are people with those remits, arts in whatever sector they're in. So that in itself shows, I think, the difference in thinking. That cross-sector approach is embedded here now. I mean, it's never enough. You can never fund all the artists to do all the things. But I think generally speaking, we are luckier here. There have been a lot of new funds, a lot of targeted efforts to support freelancers and to support theatres or performance spaces or music halls. Again, I don't think it'll ever be enough. I don't know that we'll really ever recover that industry. But yeah, it's not been great. I think most people are out of work and wondering what they can do and how to come back with something that isn't going to be cancelled 2 months later is a big ask.
Yeah, I was just sort of reflecting on mental health, and actually artists are very badly affected. You know, art is something that thrives when the economy thrives, sort of thing. And even while the economy is doing well, you know, in many parts of the world, if culturally there isn't that sort of appreciation, then people are already struggling, and they do it for passion, you know, and purpose. And yeah, one of the episodes that I did with Karina, I was asking, you know, what kind of world are we creating such that dreamers can dream and realize their dreams? And we don't have a cushion for that, you know? It's just, if you fight for it, if you want to go through it, then, like, good luck. You know, that's kind of, like, the perspective. And when we talk about mental health, I think, I don't feel like people or governments realize enough, like, that sort of disruption to artists when that's mm-hmm. their livelihood. Like, barely able to get by a lot of times. And now with COVID, if it was something that just went on for 1 year and it was, you know, starting to clear, then that's still all right, you know that after that you can resume. But what does it mean for theater practitioners? What does it mean for live performance? What does it mean for experience-based arts when everything is going digital, when your thing can't really, it's not the same thing digital, and that's your skills, your facilitation, your, you know, the things that you are doing in your art, it's not something that can necessarily be translated on a digital space. And you don't know how long this is going to last. Will it ever be back to normal? What does it mean for livelihoods? Do people have to just quit their dreams and work in something that's completely different? And these are real serious questions.
Yeah.
And also, like, socially engaged artists working with communities, having their work disrupted and also having to bear the weight of, you know, people's worries.
Mm-hmm.
Who supports them then? Mm-hmm. Like, we are not talking about this.
Yeah, it's, I think, like, you know, they've been saying here, the pandemic comes in waves. And there's like a new iteration of it every 6 months or something. And especially here, we have this new highly infectious strain, which means, you know, anyone in the UK just really can't travel to another country because, I mean, without Brexit and all of that, even before we even get started in that, this new infectious strain is like 70% more infectious than the last one and all of this. And so it's new iterations of the pandemic. And I think the mental, even after there's a vaccine and it stops, you know, the actual infectious disease stops in, you know, ravaging entire communities, the next thing is then how you deal with the mental health and the next wave of the pandemic, which is the isolation and the fractured societies and the lonely isolated humans that exist afterwards. I don't know what the plan is for that as of yet. I've yet to see a comprehensive model as to how you restore a society after it's been alone indoors for a year and a half, which is certainly what it's getting to here. It's a lot. On a personal level, I have been going back to books that remind me why this is what I want to do and why this is worth waiting for. But equally, that's very easy for me because I've not been the one hit the hardest. So, you know, I take that point and that position of privilege that I make that suggestion from. It's not the answer if you can't afford food, right? It's just if you're looking for little pockets of inspiration, then that's what I've found to be useful.
Yeah, it's heavy. So when I came back to Singapore, I was looking at different sort of like fundings and stuff, and it feels like the government's priority and interest for post-COVID recovery, it's really boosting the economy through technology. So tech space or sort of like sustainability green technology, which it's still technology. And I mean, I really, okay, well, food security is a big issue because we import like most of our food, and the government's trying to push for like high-tech farming and stuff like that. For me, it's like, just get on your hands and be with the soil and understand nature, understand our ecosystems, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And everything is like this promise that tech is going to solve everything and it's going to solve our economy. But wait a minute, you know, you are pumping all that money in there, and there is so much money in tech already. Not everyone is a tech person. Not everyone can be a tech person. The people who lose jobs are not the people in tech. What are you going to do to support these people and their livelihoods when all of these things can be replaced by AI and all of, like, you know, smart technology and softwares? People don't even need to know Photoshop anymore. You know, you've got Canva, you've got AI that's doing the work for Photoshop, like that you would have had to spend 3 years learning Photoshop for. Then what happens to artists? And, you know, we talk so much about post automation and that what's going to be left, it's, you know, either people who are working in tech or people in the creative spaces, things that robots cannot replace. But then we are not doing anything in a society now to encourage that space, that creative space, the community care space, to be able to earn a living out of it, because all of the funding and support is going towards promoting and developing the tech industry, which without government funding, it's still going to be developed.
Right. And also the people, like, even if it was only the tech companies, I mean, there are still humans working in the tech companies that we need to be there and to be healthy and to be inspired and active. And it's, you know, we know that beyond a certain income, like when you can feed yourself and house your family, like beyond that income, your quality of life doesn't change. Like it seems like it's gonna, and at a point it just, that isn't what you need, because once the basic needs are met, there has to be more. And I agree, the tech industry is not the only industry in the world, and we need to look far beyond that. But even if it were, just channeling money in and ignoring socially engaged practices still wouldn't be enough. Yeah, it just seems so obviously incorrect to me for that to be the approach. But I think all of us are probably on the same page there, that there are human beings at the center of everything. And if you don't look after them, then what are we doing? It's the economy is great, but if people still can't feed themselves, then it's not really, I don't know what it's for.
I thought of a financial model. If tech industries or like companies can fire people because AI, they can use AI to take over their jobs, then what if AI and all these machines and robots are taxed? I mean, this is not a new idea, but if they are taxed in an amount that is still going to make it cheaper for the company than to hire someone, then the amount, that difference, where it's still going to be cheaper, but then, you know, that difference with like the person's salary, then that difference becoming money that would go to hire socially engaged artists or people in the community space to actually work on things that's going to bring people together, because you have to balance both sides, right? So what if you have businesses? I mean, if you have businesses creating all of these products, economy can't grow if people cannot afford to buy stuff. And then if you're not going to provide jobs for people to be able to purchase things, we are still stuck and we cannot continue exploiting natural environments. So what if that space is funded directly by companies to be able to do this work that matters?
You've blown my mind in a little bit of a way where I'm like, wait, but no, seriously, what if it was?
Because I was researching, and IKEA has some, so Space 10 is sort of under IKEA, they're funded by IKEA, but they are like research innovation hub, and they are creating, like they are innovating and just experimenting so many super interesting things and like future food and all that stuff and technologies. And then they became this open source community space where, even though everything's open source, they became a hub for the network for everyone to come through. And then that allows IKEA to also, you know, be at the forefront of what they're doing, and that they know what future trends are. So if companies are so, you know, they are concerned about their reputation and CSR, why not just let people who are in that space to do the CSR instead of hiring managers to choose which applications or proposals to fund. You know, just hire people and they would be part of your company, give them a salary so that they can work with people, they can work on your employees' benefits or welfare, but then they can also work with other communities that need it and marginalized communities or the young or the elderly or, you know, just everyone in between and then beyond. And that's going to create a much tighter community and ecosystem. But governments have to first do it.
Right. And I'm skeptical of any plan which relies on big corporations paying their taxes. I think, you know, we know they don't. And we know that's a huge reason for a lot of the gaps in available, certainly here in the UK. They're always trying to cut the NHS and cut arts programs and cut all of this. And, you know, and then you look at the Amazons of the world that just haven't paid billions. And you're like, well, we wouldn't need to if. Anyway, that's, again, a side rant, but yeah, I mean, that would be amazing. Talk about a new paradigm shift. That would be quite something.
But if we just have one company that starts it and then more companies take that on and then it becomes a pressure for everyone to do that within their companies,
yeah,
that would be huge. But yeah, I think we have to first start with a campaign.
Yeah, well, the rise in like green type technologies makes me hopeful that at least those companies started with a socially conscious agenda, even if it gets lost in tax havens along the way. There are people there because they believe in some form of social good. So hopefully maybe those are the companies that will provide some kind of different decent and real CSR if it came to it.
What is one thing that someone can do to create change in this world?
I mean they could do anything. I'm a firm believer that just by existing you're making positive change. I was in a we co-present Visioning Labs with Lincoln Center in New York. And they're just on, they're online CSR basically for teaching artists, and it's using artistic inquiry. And someone said, we were talking about heritage and generations ago, what would your ancestors say if they could see you now? And someone had said, they would just be so proud that you existed. You wouldn't need to do it anymore. And I was like, huh. Because I think probably like you, I'm a consistent sort of high achiever, always striving for more, always, you know, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. But I think there is a sort of poetic beauty in just the fact existing is enough. And if you can channel your inherent abilities to make someone else's existence nicer, that is incredible. And that's more than most, right? So existing is enough, especially in a pandemic. Whatever you are is plenty. But if you can spare a little extra to make someone else's existence better, that would be my, whether it's at scale or just like feeding someone, you know, buying them their weekly shop, that is, I think, as much as we can reasonably ask for from people at the moment. So yeah, that I've been thinking about that a lot. Just existing is plenty for now.
Yeah. Where can people find out more about iTech?
So it's, our website is probably the best place of upcoming opportunities. It's ITAC, so itac-collaborative.com. And we have all our upcoming opportunities, events, engagement opportunities, everything. Sometimes there are little pots of money available to do teaching artist projects. Sometimes it's an invitation to be an advisor on someone's project or to lead something. We're just launching about 12 new projects. So there are loads at the moment at various levels that people can engage with. We're about to launch a new think tank series. So every 2 months, it will be the beginning of a new working group on a topic of the host's choice. And we've always done these every month, but every second month now, the host will be paid to do a deep dive into the topic with a working group afterwards. So it will continue beyond that one event, which is cool and I'm excited. So if people have an area of expertise they want to explore in the next couple of weeks, we'll be inviting them to apply to host one of these with artists from around the world. So yeah, do visit and find out if you can be engaged and contribute and stuff.
Sounds amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello Onions Talk listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, it would really help if you can leave a review on iTunes or like us on Facebook. Otherwise, subscribe and share it with people whom you think will enjoy this. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode.